for 83 and 84. We will be for 85 and 86 unless you
maintain the disconnect.
Right.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
I'd prefer maintaining the disconnect. And to your concern, the federal government is cutting back social programs, and we do need to support local private social providers. I would remind myself, I'm thinking out loud, that the 50% AGI limit is a pretty hefty one. The people who are financially supporting private organizations still have it available to them in the itemized form. And that's where the support for our community organizations are coming from. They're not coming from the person that's making 20,000 AGI or less. They're having a hard enough time doing their own thing. I just maintain the disconnect on non-itemizers.
What do we allow now? Do we allow anything?
Zero.
Zero?
On non-itemizers.
For?
Charitable contributions.
Right. They would just be eligible for the standard deduction, which is 13% of AGI between a $1,050 minimum and a $1,500 maximum.
Do I hear objection to staying where we are on this item? Hearing no objection, we'll go to number 5.
Okay, number 5 deals with the current state interest and dividend exclusion, which is different from the Fed's. The state now has a $200 single and $400 exclusion. There can be a combination of interest and dividend income. The feds now have a $100 single, $200 joint exclusion for dividend income only. This was suggested by the CPAs in relationship to the net interest exclusion provision in the Reform Act, but it's still a separate item from that. This, if you allowed the lower exclusion, there's a potential revenue pickup here of about $22 million biennium.
Yes, Representative Hugo?
Steve, one of the questions we were batting about when we were discussing this was first of all, who defines dividend income and how will that be defined? For example, a share in a credit union is labeled as dividend.
I would like the department to respond to that if you don't mind.
Okay. Madam Chair.
On their what they use for the definition.
Okay. Madam Chair, we could assume the same issue. When you have a money market fund composed of securities and bonds, is that interest or is that dividends? And we are getting an amalgam of financial instruments that seem to blur into each other. Where is the line drawn between dividends and interest?
I have not looked at the federal definition of dividends.
For Lane, it looks like it's her.
It's my question.
Yeah.
For the record, I'm Verlina Crosley, Oregon Department of Revenue. The definitions are very clear in the federal code, and generally dividends are those dollars that are paid out of your earnings and profits from a corporation, generally. Some things are called dividends, but they're treated like interest. For example, if you have a credit union account, like I do, then it's called a dividend on my statement, but it's truly just interest. Interest is more those items that you would get from, you know, your bank accounts, savings accounts, etc. But they are clearly defined in the statutes. There's some very clear lines between them.
Does the federal definition tie dividends to ownership? For example, ownership of a corporation? Obviously, that would be a dividend payment coming back.
Right. You would have to have some kind of stock bought in that company to get a dividend. And so you would have to have ownership, yeah.
So if I didn't own something, it would be interest. If I did own something, it may be dividends.
Representative Hugo, I think that for the most part you would be right. There may be a few exceptions that I don't know right offhand, but for the most part you would be right.
Madam Chair?
Representative Schoon, then Representative Hugo. Hanlon. And then Representative Corey, who's been very quiet.
Yeah. What are the Oregon amounts now?
200 for up to 200 for single return, up to 400 for joint return.
Okay. Is that split between dividends and interest, or is it combined?
Any combination of the two. That
any combination. It's 400 200 on a single, and on the Fed it is
100 single, 200 joint,
200
dividends only.
Dividends only.
Can we take a bundle?
Representative Hammer.
Question of the department. Where you have a mutual fund that buys stocks and bonds, I assume that deals with dividends rather than interest.
Representative Hamlin, I believe that would be interest.
But those stocks and bonds owned by the mutual fund collect dividends and then redistribute them to me as an owner of the mutual fund. Why would that be interest rather than dividends?
Representative Hamlin, there's specific laws on municipal mutual fund, there's some allocation methods. For example, if there's like 50% sent out, and there's just some different rules that deal with mutual funds rather than just your regular bank accounts or regular stock. I think for the most part, those are treated as interest, though. But I'll defer to Don because he's done some more research in that. I know that some of it is interest, and some of it may be dividends also.
Thank you.
I'll defer to Don.
Okay. Don Charlton, Department of Revenue. Generally, when you are investing in a mutual fund, you're buying shares in the mutual fund, and when they're paying those out, those are dividends. They can take on, for federal, they can take on the character of, for example, tax-exempt interest from bonds and that and so forth, but they are generally characterized as dividends received from the mutual fund.
Does that answer your question, Representative Hanlon?
Not. It opens up a whole bunch more, I think.
That's what the committee process is all about.
Yeah. I think I'll defer any further questions.
Yeah, sure.
I'll represent school.
Steve, no. What was the fiscal impact, again, of going to the Fed?
22.
Right. Yes, about a $22 million increase in revenue for the biennium by reducing the amount of basically interest and perhaps dividends that can income on the return.
Okay, that would be the complete elimination of interest.
Yes.
And we would allow only dividend income. What would the fiscal impact be if we went to the federal limits, in other words, 100 and 200, but allowed either dividends or interest? Do you have any idea?
Not offhand.
My preference would be to leave it the way we are. And I know the whole purpose of this subcommittee is to reconnect the federal code. We are a capital poor state, and it seems to me I'm going to presume that, especially in terms of interest, that people primarily invest in their own state, have their savings, their IRAs, et cetera, et cetera. And I know that we want to conform, and I know that we want to be simple, but I still think we reward people for spending and we penalize them for saving, and I just have a hard time with that whole system that we've encouraged by our tax policies in some ways.
Well, I agree with what you're saying, and we do not encourage people to save, really, and that, of course, is why we changed these limits in the first place, but but I don't agree with the statement that we're a capital poor state. Now, I keep hearing that over and over again, but there's really so much movement of capital, and capital will go to good investments. And
I will yield to our resident banker.
Rates of return. Well, I know it's an argument that a lot of people use, and I suppose I accepted it for years and years, but I just am developing strong doubts about it. But what I was thinking was that I'm not, and I'm not sure, I'm not suggesting this, but if we went to the federal limits but also included interest, I think it would encourage the small saver. And I guess personally I'm more interested in encouraging the small saver than I am the small investor of stocks and bonds. But if we went to either or, it would give us a pretty substantial amount of money, I think. And maybe we could do some of these other things that we've looked at and declined to do if we had this additional money. In other words, we could reconnect to some of these other things in larger amounts if we also connected to the Fed. But I would be very interested in including interest as well as dividends in any combination.
Question for Steve.
Yes, but
we're operating under a $60 million estimate. Revenue enhancement upon reconnect. Is this $22 million part of that 60?
No.
So we'd be picking up an additional $20 million.
Yes.
Well, except that we wouldn't have the whole amount because that's a complete elimination of the interest. Maybe half or something like that. It wouldn't be enough to do that one, for example, $15 million.
Okay. Well, I'm curious, federal policy, why they're excluding interest at all and just allowing the benefit to the dividend. I would do it just the other way around.
Yeah.
What do we have, 200 and 400?
Yes.
My first choice is to stay where we are. My second choice is to go with you. That's my second choice.
Story of your life, John.
Yeah.
Let the record show.
Madam Chairman, why don't we just go on and just kind of keep that in mind, maybe as an alternative in case we felt strongly
okay.
about other issues.
All right. Rip St. Clory, you feel free to jump in whenever.
Like child care credit.
Yeah.
Like child care credit. Number six.
Okay. There's most of the following provisions here now are in the bill that the department suggested, so that I'll probably need some help from them on some of these questions as we go on down the page. And the rest of these, at least on the front page, are not revenue items as such. There might be some minor changes, but they're not looked at as major revenue items. Number six.
Steve, I wonder if I interrupt this thing. Would you explain number nine in relation to number four? I'm sorry, number nine in relation to number five.
Basically, the reference in the state statutes for the definition of interest was moved to another section of the code, as I understand, and so that we needed to restate where that definition of interest is in the state law.
For interest deduction.
Yes.
But we're considering under number five not allowing interest deduction.
Right. If you didn't allow an interest deduction, then you wouldn't need that definition there, I don't think.
That's right. Well, doesn't five deal with exclusions and nine deal with deductions?
No, it's the same interest. Sometimes it's called an exclusion, sometimes a deduction.
Is that it?
I was not consistent with my terminology.
I think the point is that whatever the decision is on 5 is going to affect the decision on 9. Is that the first statement?
Yes.
Okay. Well.
Yes.
Can we have the department comment on it?
On 9, deduction was used where exclusion should have been used. What we are talking about here is the definition of interest qualifying for the exclusion. When the federal government eliminated their interest dividend exclusion, they also eliminated their definition of excludable interest.
Okay, it doesn't refer to IRA or KEO interest necessarily.
No, it does not.
Are we ready to go on?
Okay, back to number six then. Currently there are certain items that are calculated as a percent of adjusted gross income. One is, of course, that we have mentioned already is the charitable amount that can be itemized, it's being 50%. There's a, I think that still the medical deduction maximum is a percent of AGI. Our standard deduction is 13% of AGI. The issue is what definition of AGI should be used in those calculations. Should it be the federal definition or should it be a state definition if different from federal? Now, if we reconnect the state definition and federal definition, of course, will be the same for 1985. But if there are federal changes that affect AGI subsequent to that in 1986, then there could be a difference between the state definition of AGI and the federal definition. And the department for is suggesting to use the federal definition so that once you have made some made maybe one calculation on the federal return using federal AGI, you don't have to go back and recalculate that using state AGI,
which is the good news. I'm sure.
Yes, definitely.
The bad news is, as we are sunny die out missing around doing our normal life work, and the Congress is missing around with it, we're also adopting those provisions as well. Is that correct?
Adopting
if the Congress adjusts their definition of AGI.
Oh yes, as far as those limits are concerned, yes.
Well, question for Steve. Steve, hasn't it been our practice to adopt the federal code as of a certain date?
Yes.
Well, and I think we have to decide at this point whether it's December 31st, 1984 or January 1st, 1985 or something like that, or for the tax years coming into effect. But anyway, we haven't typically adopted anything prospectively, have we? In other words, if we adopt the AGI definition, it'll be the AGI definition as of a certain date. So any future changes wouldn't affect it, would it?
Joseph, is there something?
Berlina?
Madam Chair, I'd like to respond to the Representative Skoon's comment. Basically, it only affects the AGI for purposes of limitation. So, for example, if you had a $12,000 AGI on your federal return and a $10,000 AGI on your Oregon return, then you would use that $12,000 for your percent limitations for, like, medical, for example. You can have 5%, and you take it times. In this case, it would be times the 12% under the bill as written instead of the 10%. So in some cases, that's going to be sometimes that's going to be a greater deduction, and sometimes that's going to be a lesser deduction, depending on what's on the federal return. What it means for the taxpayer is that they do not have to use a separate Schedule A and the related schedules for the Oregon return. But it does not just adopt those other laws. It only uses the AGI for purposes of those limitations.
Just to make sure I understood what you said, so that if we adopt this, that will not mean that the Oregon AGI will necessarily be the same as the state. It'll just be for those particular and special calculations like medical expenses and so on.
Representative Skoon, yes, that is correct.
And that would be prospective then, so that if the Fed did change in the future, then that calculation would change somewhat, but not dramatically necessarily, and it wouldn't affect the amount that the Oregon taxpayer would report as AGI. It will not affect that. Except as that small adjustment through some kind of deduction over here.
That's right. It affects things like standard deduction, because that's 13% of an AGI item. So every other year we have had to recompute, or the taxpayers had to recompute their federal adjusted gross income. As of a particular date, because that's what we're tied to. So there's additional worksheets, there's additional schedules that they have to use to come up with sort of an as-if federal income or federal AGI. So yes, for purposes of that AGI computation, it would only be used for those limitation purposes. You would not be connecting to all those items in AGI except for that limitation purposes.
Okay.
Okay, I know what, I think I know what you're saying, but tell me how that affects the standard deduction or
okay. The current law, Representative Schoon, says that for the standard deduction, the maximum is 13%.
From state.
Pardon me?
From a state.
Yes, state standard deduction is 13% times your adjusted gross income.
Okay, but which adjusted gross income?
Well, the interpretation of the attorneys that we've relied in is says the federal adjusted gross income, and since we're tied to a particular date, it would be the federal adjusted gross income as of, in this case, December 31, 1984.
Well, I guess I don't understand why your attorneys determined that it should be 13% of federal instead of 13% of Oregon AGI.
There's nothing in the law that says, there's no definition of Oregon adjusted gross income. The only definition is federal adjusted gross income, because that's what we're tied to. So for years, since we've had the disconnects, we've had to have a section on the Oregon return called the Oregon Change Section, and that gets us to federal adjusted gross income as of a particular date. So you would take your first line on your Oregon return is the federal adjusted gross income, and then you have to take certain things that were not tied to and add or subtract them depending on their effect, and then you come up with what is now on the Oregon return Oregon adjusted gross income. But there is no such thing in the statute. Really what you're doing is getting back to what your federal adjusted gross income would have been.
That you're talking about, we've got federal adjusted gross income, then we make these adjustments.
Right.
Excluding, for example, the deduction for subtracting or adding back in the Social Security, for example, and then we end up with what we call or describe an Oregon adjusted gross income.
Right.
But, okay, we've got two figures now.
Right.
But in computing the standard deduction, the Oregon individual uses the upper figure, the federal?
They would under the bill. Currently, they use the Oregon adjusted gross income figure on the return.
The people that would be affected by that would be the ones that are in the middle. If you itemize the minimum, or excuse me, if you take the standard deduction, the minimum is $1,050. Now, at about 8,000 AGI, for anything less than that, 18% of your AGI is less than $1,050, so you get $1,050. The 13% of AGI comes into play for those that have AGI between 8 and about 11,500, I believe it was. If your AGI is beyond that, you're limited by the $1,500 maximum now. So you're talking about this group of taxpayers, whether 13% of their AGI is a little bit more or less, depending upon what definition you have.
I think Representative Schoon and I both forgot about the cap, and we were thinking of 13% of a million.
There is a cap.
There is a cap.
I think we're happy.
Yeah.
Okay. I think we're happy with number six.
Less frightened.
Do we know the revenue impact?
There would be pluses and minuses, and as far as I know, there's no significant revenue impact here. It would basically only affect 1 year of the biennium as well.
I get to number seven.
I assume we're okay on number six.
Yes, we are okay on number six. Do I hear any objections to number six? Hearing no objections, we will go to number seven.
I think the department would like to pass over this one right now and come back to it later. There's some problems with the way 2011 is written relative to what was adopted by the committee for the non-resident taxpayer.
The border war?
Yes.
What have we done, Marlena?
You want me to tell you?
Please.
Dave, Hugo, in the bill that was passed in a special session, which is basically the bill that was repassed again, except for continuing it in this committee, there's a separate provision if you have a four-year resident and then a non-resident spouse, or a four-year resident and a part-year spouse, which is what our section in the bill dealt with. But there is no exception if you have a non-resident and a part-year resident that are married to fall into an exception where they could file a separate return. We knew that last session. It came out of a special session. We didn't realize it until the session was over. And by rule, we said that those people in that instance would file a 40P return, which is the part-year return, which our attorneys tell us is really not legal because it taxes the non-resident in a manner that is not allowed by law. But there's nothing in the law that tells how to tax in that type of situation. What you basically have to do is have a form where one spouse would use one tax rate and the other spouse would use another tax rate, and then you'd add the two together, I guess. That's sort of what they're thinking. And we're really not sure exactly how to handle that. They're not.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Hamlin?
It would be my intent in dealing with this issue to carry out the intent of 2737, the bill that passed out of this committee and is in the House and is now on the Senate side in dealing with this matter.
Can we do it in the Senate? Does the party have a proposed amendment to 2737 that we could deal with in the Senate?
We will, Representative Hugo, because we do know it's a problem. We just aren't sure exactly how legally to do that.
Okay,
so we will come back to number 7.
Are you suggesting to delete this out of the bill in this section and deal with it in the other bill?
Well, I think the department's got to figure out what they want to do first.
Yeah.
And then we'll figure out what the best vehicle may be.
Well, I think that we should be pretty specific in our intent, and maybe Tom should restate what he said.
Madam Chair, and I did that for the purposes of this record in this committee, is it would be my intent to carry out the purposes and intent of House Bill 2737 in repealing the border wars issues. And to, once you know what's legal, to offer your amendments so they are consistent with the intent of the repeal of those rates.
Madam Chair.
That's good.
Does the department have any problem with that? And you've thought about this somewhat. Do you have any problem with that?
Representative Schoon, what the session in House Bill 2011 did was repeal that one exception where you can have a joint return filed at the federal level, but a separate return filed at the state level, because when it was put in, it was because there was only about 200 returns that even fell into that category, and sort of an exception process. Okay, what we would have in the situation that I just described is another exception, basically, in addition to what this one would be.
And that exception would be the people who have one spouse who is a full-time Oregon resident and another spouse who is a non-resident.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. For example, if I live in Oregon this year and I marry somebody from Washington, for example, and then we move to Washington, you really have a situation like I'm talking about, because you have a part-year resident and you have a non-resident. And there is nothing in the law to say what return, how those two people would be taxed. Because if they file a joint return, theoretically, the non-resident is supposed to be taxed one way and the part-year resident is supposed to be taxed another way. And there's nothing in the law that addresses that situation.
Okay, you're talking about a part-year Oregon resident and a
full non-resident. Full-year non-resident.
Full-year non-resident. Okay, I mentioned what about the case of the full-year Oregon resident and the spouse that's a full-year non-resident?
In those instances, since we didn't know we had a problem coming in with our bill, House Bill 20, or the governor's bill, and our provision, we had wanted those people to file a 40P, which is the part-year return. because the non-resident would just put their income in the non-taxable portion or the non-Oregon income, and then the full-year resident would, Oregon resident, would put their income in the Oregon column. And that sounded like then we could get rid of that exception to filing separate returns, and everything would be okay. And that's when our attorney said that there was a problem with even the old law, and the two sort of come together. So we don't really know how to deal with that situation either, in answer to your question.
Okay, but both of these situations are very, very similar.
Yes, they are very similar. Right. And you know, what we might have to go to is just add, and not be able to get rid of the exception, and just expand the exception to be legal.
I did, there,
if that's what this committee wants.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I didn't hear that. What we may have to go to is what?
If the intention is to, in all cases, make the non-resident be taxed a different way than the part-year resident, in a different way than the full-year Oregon resident, in those instances, we may just have to expand the exceptions, and there you would have to have a separate filing in those instances.